KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Santa Clara.
Santa Cruz.
Union City.
Hayward.
San Francisco.
I'm from Fremont.
Yo, I'm San Jose, just downtown.
Coming up, after the fires, the question remains, what's killing California trees by the millions?
When they're brown like this, they're dead. They're not coming back.
Then workers at the Tesla factory say the company has violated labor laws.
I noticed I'm losing my grip, I'm dropping things. My hands are aching every time I take a break. Ended up being carpal tunnel syndrome in both hands.
And how do young Black immigrants and Black Americans relate today?
You know, I don't question the intention of Black women, maybe the way I did when I was younger, because I was insecure about my Blackness.
That's coming up today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. The recent fires in Northern California were the worst in the state's history, and fire scientists expect more of these extreme blazes to become the norm. Millions of dead trees turn forests into tinderboxes, and many of those trees were killed by one tiny culprit, the bark beetle. These native pests chew their way through evergreens, sometimes cutting through 100,000 trees in a day. There are currently more than 100 million dead trees in the state waiting to fall or burn. Unprecedented numbers. In this story from our archives, KALW's Angela Johnston took a closer look at the massive tree die-off.
If you need help finding dead trees and bark beetles, Tom Smith is your guy. He works for the California Department of Forestry and Fire, identifying and managing tree diseases and pests.
I'm just a bugs and rot man.
A bugs and rot man.
And if you want to find bugs and rot close to the Bay Area, Smith says head up to Mount Diablo in Contra Costa County. So I meet him there, in a parking lot at the base of the mountain. He points up a steep hill to a green pine forest, blemished by brown, dying trees.
They are evergreen trees. When they're brown like this, they're dead. They're not coming back.
Usually 1% of trees die each year due to insects, disease, overcrowding, or fire. Right now, Smith says we're dealing with annual mortality rates in the 25 to 80% range. Climate change and the drought have made the trees weaker.
And the bark beetles really like trees that are under stress, and the drought puts the trees under stress.
Smith can't tell me how many trees on Mount Diablo are infested with bark beetles, but he does say it's nothing compared to how many trees are dying in the southern Sierra Nevada, almost 80%. And right now, the dead trees are a major fire hazard.
They're around all these communities, so they're adding just a fuel load to the forest that they don't need. They're already having major fires down there. We don't need more fires. But if we can't get this wood out, that it's just going to sit there and be more fuel that can burn in more fires, more huge fires in the future.
That's where the state comes in. Last fall, Governor Brown issued an emergency proclamation urging city, regional, and state agencies to bypass environmental regulations to cut down trees. Trees that have already burned, and also ones that are losing the battle with bark beetles, in danger of burning later. And you don't have to look further than Lake County, 2 hours north of San Francisco, to see this happening. On Cobb Mountain in Lake County, the land still bears the scars from last fall's devastating valley fire. Most of the hills are still charred black. There are patches of green forest here and there where a sudden change of wind steered the flames in a different direction. But these green surviving trees may not be here for much longer, because in Lake County, bark beetles are killing most of what is left.
This is a new area right here that's, I'd say they've been in here probably at least 4 months.
Danny Prather is a fifth-generation timber operator. Basically, that means he has a permit to cut down trees. This year, he says more than half the trees he's cutting down are ones that have already been infested by beetles.
That patch of orange right up there, a couple hundred yards, that I cut every tree in there last year that I thought was going to die. And even with that and removing the ones with active beetles still in it, it's still they still come back and spread.
Today, he's cutting down, or felling, a few ponderosa pine trees to thin out the forest near his house. A sparser group of trees makes it harder for bark beetles to move from tree to tree. Prather says mills in California don't want to buy pine. It's not as valuable as redwood or cedar. And because the local mills are full, he, along with the rest of the state, has to find other markets for the wood. This tree and the dozens of others he'll fell this year will get put on a truck bed, transported to the port of Richmond, put on a boat, and shipped to China. Prather will make just enough money to break even.
They're paying more than our own mills, which I don't know how that can work out financially. But more importantly, it gets our dead wood out of the forest, which is a good thing.
Clearing trees that are already dead is good for preventing fires, but some experts think we shouldn't be so quick to cut the green ones down and ship them away. Here's UC Berkeley law professor Eric Bieber.
One of the concerns is that if people cut trees instead of letting the beetles kill the trees, in the long run, that may actually interfere with the ability of these forests and these pine species to adapt to a future of climate change.
Bieber co-authored a paper with environmental scientist Diana Six that suggested waiting to see what bark beetles could tell us about climate change and how trees could fight back. Basically, they want to let natural selection run its course. But he admits it's hard to sit by when beautiful green vistas around California are starting to fade away.
A lot of places and ecosystems that we are used to living in, and that we associate looking in a certain way and feeling in a certain way, will start changing. And we'll have these urges to do something about it. And it's not clear to me that we will be doing good things.
On the ride back down from Danny Prather's land on Cobb Mountain, I passed the Bog Demonstration State Forest. It used to be a recreation area that was also used for research. Now it's full of dead trees, 90% of them burned in the Valley Fire. For many here in Lake County, the view is a constant reminder of the huge loss the fire brought to this community. But some people see an opportunity. The forest could be a blank slate, a place to plant and test different trees that could resist future beetle attacks, and maybe find a way to manage the epidemic by planting trees instead of cutting them down. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
If you've got an environmental story you'd like to see reported, email Angela at environment@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. It's been a couple of weeks of bad news for Tesla, the company that makes electric cars in Fremont. Tesla announced they're falling behind in producing their new car, the Model 3. The company also revealed that they've lost more than $600 million last quarter, and shares in the company dropped about 7%. And they have labor troubles on the horizon. Next week, a federal judge is hearing charges that the company illegally intimidated employees who were trying to form a union. KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wirtschafter is here to talk with me about it. So, Eli, catch us up. What is the background here?
Okay, so Tesla, of course, is the electric car company run by Elon Musk, the multi-billionaire investor slash inventor who wants to send us to space and private rockets with SpaceX, or send us to Los Angeles on a faster-than-sound Hyperloop. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's also the CEO of Tesla. Mm-hmm. And Tesla builds high-end electric vehicles right here in the Bay Area in South Fremont.
Right.
That factory has around 10,000 workers. It's one of the largest employers in the Bay Area. And this is in the same building, the same factory where General Motors partnered with Toyota to learn about how to run an efficient and relatively happy car factory starting in the 80s. That project, what was called the NUMMI plant, closed in 2010, mm-hmm. and Tesla bought the factory.
Right.
Now, some of the current Tesla employees used to work at the NUMMI factory, which was unionized.
Right.
And now they work for Tesla, which is not.
Mm. And so now some of them are trying to form a union.
Right. So this started in February, at least publicly. There was a Tesla employee, his name is Jose Moran, who put up a kind of essay online complaining about the working conditions at the plant. Specifically, he says they had relatively low pay, a relatively high injury rate. He said some employees were working 60 to 70 hours a week because of forced overtime. And he said that a lot of workers feel like they can't complain about their injuries or their challenges with their schedule to their bosses out of fear of retaliation or being labeled a bad worker.
Mm-hmm.
And this employee said they needed to form a union in order to get heard. So workers who are interested in this have teamed up with the United Automobile Workers Union, the UAW, and they've kept coming forward with more of their stories. So here's a clip from a video made by UAW with an employee whose name is Alan Ochoa. He says he works on the assembly line, sometimes the 12-hour shifts, doing the same thing all day long.
After so long, I noticed I'm losing my grip. I'm dropping things. My hands are aching every time I take a break. Ended up being carpal tunnel syndrome in both hands.
Ochoa is younger than 30, and he says he's at risk of being permanently disabled. And a lot of the employees in these videos, you know, talking to press, they say they're really proud to work at Tesla. They love its mission of producing environmentally friendly cars of the future, but they say they're working under conditions of the past.
Mm-hmm. So how has Tesla responded to these complaints?
They basically said, well, we've had some problems, but we're making things a lot safer. Tesla said the rate of injuries and illnesses dropped 30% between the beginning of 2016 and 2017. So now they say they have a higher safety record than the industry average.
Okay.
And so they're saying now basically that having a union would make Tesla like all the other old car companies and basically bring their safety record back down again.
Hmm.
Now, that has not stopped workers who want to form a union. And since that statement by Tesla in May, other complaints have come out.
Mm-hmm.
In August, workers said they were being regularly exposed to toxic chemicals without getting proper training to handle them. And in October, three black employees said they faced racist harassment from coworkers and even managers, included repeated use of the N-word and, quote, racist caricatures, images, and effigies around the factory.
Wow.
Tesla has either denied everything or said it's just an isolated incident. And they say any of these campaigns are sort of timed to coincide, this is a quote, to coincide with a carefully planned media blitz in an attempt to create a disingenuous narrative that was at odds with the facts.
So many different complaints against Tesla. What legal actions are the employees taking?
Okay, so working with the UAW, some employees have brought a number of charges to the National Labor Relations Board. That's
mm-hmm.
the federal agency that defends the workers' rights to unionize.
Okay.
Three former or current employees at the Fremont plant say that on several occasions they were passing out pro-union leaflets, literature in the factory parking lot,
mm-hmm.
and company representatives intimidated them or told them to go away. Now, after they filed those initial claims, one of the three workers, his name is Richard Ortiz,
mm-hmm.
was fired. And he says Tesla fired him as retaliation because he was trying to form a union, which would definitely be illegal.
Hmm.
The labor board still has to look into that charge and other complaints as well.
Okay, so what are the possible consequences for Tesla?
Usually these kind of cases don't come with fines or penalties. Tesla could be given a cease and desist order, and they could also be made to reinstate any employees who were fired.
Uh-huh. So why does this all matter? I mean, is this going to be a big deal? How important is this case to the UAW and other unions?
I talked to a writer named Chris Brooks about this. He writes for the pro-union group Labor Notes. And he says that Tesla is an important battleground both symbolically and practically. Symbolically because this was the site of the NUMMI plant, which was such an important place for showing what the working conditions of the future could look like.
Mm-hmm.
And practically, he says, it's a test case for whether the new electric car industry will be unionized or not. You know, Tesla is the first American car maker to go public since Ford in 1956.
Mm.
And right now, the Fremont plant is the only U.S. car factory owned by an American company that doesn't have a union. So stakes are high for UAW. They don't want car factories to compete with each other to lower wages or decrease benefits. They want everyone to be unionized. So with Tesla, I think they want to prove that even with new companies, even with electric cars, if you're an American automaker, you're going to have a union.
Eli Wertschafter is KALW's transportation reporter. Contact him at transportation@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and I host a podcast called The Stoop with my former colleague here at KALW, Leela Day. It's about what it means to be Black and how we talk about Blackness. So in a recent episode, we were talking about how the African immigrant population in the U.S. has doubled every decade since the 1970s, and the relationship between these immigrants and the Black American population has been complicated. Back when I was in school, it was the Black kids who teased and bullied me, asking whether I lived in a hut or calling me names. So what's it been like since that time? We're going to listen in on a frank conversation between Shadin Awad, a young Sudanese woman from Fremont, and her two African-American girlfriends. They talk about stereotypes, tensions between their communities, and how they relate as Black women today. We'll start with Shadin and a clapping game she used to play in elementary school.
Mailman, mailman, do your duty. Here comes a lady with the African booty.
Here comes a lady with the African booty.
I remember my mom like rolled up into school and heard it. Like she heard them saying it in like the courtyard. And she was like, and I was singing it too. You know, I didn't like, for the sake of acceptance, I didn't really think much about it. I kind of was like, okay, here comes a lady with the African booty. And here comes my mom, this African woman. And she's completely like insulted by it. You know, she's just like, why are you singing this? Why can't you say, here comes the lady with the African, you know, beauty?
My name is Iman England.
My name is Samantha Mims.
One of the first things I wanted to talk about was this big stereotype that a lot of people have about Africa, which is that Africa is only about what? Poverty, the war,
famine, genocide, all the horrible things.
Right.
Being from Africa was just bad. You just didn't want to be associated with being from Africa in any shape or form.
There would always be like that tall, skinny Black guy who just kind of like looked at like what people thought, you know, starving people in Africa look like. And it would just be like, oh, here comes so-and-so. And they would start like clicking their tongue or you know, sort of saying or, you know, like speaking with some accent. You know, and it's so weird because it's like, for me, like being from Sudan, it was like, even the foods, like there isn't this, like the same way we get upset with like sort of Blackness being a monolith, like Africa was not a country, but it was like even the stereotypes that came out of it were very country-esque, you know, as if everybody there looked the same, if everybody there, you know, like spoke the same way. Like I remember just being like, wait, like in the back of my head, like observing, like, where is that coming from, you know? But
it's coming from ignorance.
Yeah, it is, it is. Sure.
I dated a guy who is Nigerian, and I remember so many times feeling like, wow, this is like really interesting because it's almost like dating like a white person. Mm. And I was like, it's so interesting because we look so similar and we, you know, have these other things in common, but culturally, like we are significantly different. Mm-hmm. So either I felt like it was dating a white person or I felt like I was the white person where it's like, wow, like, tell me about your food. Like, tell me about this Nigerian music. Like, I've never heard it. It's just, I felt so, what's the word? Like, you know, I don't want, you never want to treat somebody like they're in a zoo and that like, wow, you're so different from me. He was nervous about me meeting his mom because she has underlying issues with African-American women and that he could foresee that being an issue. And so, of course, I'm like, oh, well, tell me more about that, you know, like whatever, because I just had never even considered that.
That brings us to our next stereotype, that Africans think they're better than African-Americans.
Are we going to go there?
I mean,
there is a perception that African people who come into this country think they're better than African Americans. And Shaddon has a lot to say about that. I mean, she has a lot of feelings about how her community behaves, how Sudanese people behave, and what they say.
It doesn't matter if I have a college degree. It doesn't matter if you talk quote unquote white or if you do these things. We're Black, and embrace that with all its complexities, you know, the good that comes with it, because all of us, you know, check off African-American, we check out, you know, like, we do reap the benefits, but at the same time we want to distance ourselves when it gets ugly. Again, sort of playing into this very blaming narrative of Black folks rather than understanding the political nature of what occurred in the States, particularly here in the United States. And I think that's something Sudanese people across the community, even in the Bay Area, can't seem to grasp, is that, like, you are not different. You are not.
Many African immigrants are highly educated. They do come in with their bachelor's degrees. A lot of them came in with that diversity lottery where it's a must that you have a bachelor's degree before you're allowed to come in. But on the other hand, they're also more likely to be in poverty. So,
like, doctors driving taxis, engineers and lawyers working as janitors, lower paying jobs.
Right. There's this big, like, a mismatch between the expectation and then the reality that they come and find.
Hi, may I help you?
Yeah, what kind of wings y'all got?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We don't serve wings.
Well, you got fries?
No.
Well, what the hell y'all got then, monkey nuts?
This is a film. This is a clip from a movie, a new film. It's actually called African Booty Scratcher.
Of course it's called that.
And it's by a Sierra Leonean filmmaker. Her name is Nikiata Jusu. She's out of Brooklyn. She said she wanted to make a movie that reflects her reality as a daughter of African immigrants who grew up here. And so it's about a family that owns a restaurant. And in the scene, the mom is wiping down the counter, getting ready for customers. And this guy walks in.
We mostly serve stews and rice.
Yo, I ain't trying to rob you, man. Hey, yo, you know what? I'm gonna just go across the street to them because at least they know what the we like.
Go then, we don't need your business. People are so ignorant.
It's you people. Yo, you sound like Whitey right now. Hey, you Africans, kill me! Coming over here acting like you better than us. Well, here in the United States, you's a you ain't nothing but a just like me. Just a with a passport.
After hearing that, that makes me feel a lot of things, right? And we've been talking about stereotypes on both sides.
Right.
And they're hurtful, they're painful, but in the end, I mean, we're all still Black.
Right. And the good news is, you know, academics who've studied the relationship between African immigrants and African Americans, they say that negativity really becomes less when each side starts learning more about the other side. Like, for African Americans to learn more about colonialism in Africa, and for immigrants to learn more about slavery in the U.S., about segregation, about Jim Crow. So they say when that happens, the groups start relating to each other, like Shaddon and her friends.
There's something that happens with Black people and with Black women where it's like if you can put aside the jargon that's been created via, you know, white supremacy and colonialism and all, it's just, it's so deep and it's so authentic. And we can talk about everything from like hair to skin to men, to women, to whatever it is we want to talk about, you know what I mean? To politics, to identity, and nothing beats it.
And it's up to us to share that.
Right.
That's the other thing. Like, we're not, that information sharing is happening between us. It's not going to happen from people that don't look like us.
Yeah, I'm totally with it. Like, this exchange of experiences that all culminate to this, like, really beautiful non-monolithic Black experience.
We all just Black. We're the same for real. And like, there's no difference in my eyes.
You know, I don't question the intention of Black women, maybe the way I did when I was younger, because I was insecure about my Blackness. But now I just feel this like
automatic like sisterhood. Mm-hmm. I just like, I'm really down with my sisters and I feel that like deeply and I want to commit myself to that.
That was an excerpt from the podcast, The Stoop, whose radio home is right here at KALW. You can hear the full episode and subscribe to the show at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. That does it for our show today. The Cross Currents team includes Atemu Atan, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by vibraphonist Mark Clifford from Oakland. Clifford is joined by his Dirty Snacks Ensemble in a 3-month residency at the Ivy Hoot. That's within Albany's Ivy Room beginning Wednesday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.